All right.
Oh, hey, everyone. It's Molly Wood. Hello.
Hello.
Hey, everybody. It's Kai. This is Make Me Smart, where Molly and I get together to talk about tech and the economy and culture and you, because this is what it's all about. You get to weigh in, because, as we like to say, none of us is as smart as all of us. I'm going to say that again. You.
I know. I really like how you're taking care of the audience today.
I know. That's me.
We're here for you.
I'm the caring soul in this podcast. Had you not noticed?
How are you guys feeling? Do you need a hug?
Yeah, that's me.
Today we're it's not a feel good show. So, I'm going to throw that out there now. And maybe I don't know, it's not a feel good show. We are going to do an episode today about something that I've been sort of obsessed with for a while, and it fits into so many trends, which, you know, is our favorite thing. We're going to connect some dots today.
Ooh.
It fits into conversations about wealth and inequality and how capitalism works and does not work. And also a little bit of a pulling back of the curtain on a force behind American capitalism that I think people aren't that aware of.
It's called money, people. Money is that force. in the form of a thing called private equity. And what we're going to talk about with our very special guest today is private equity in the retail space. And here's why, just as a case in point. A couple of years ago, you might remember Toys R Us went bankrupt, right? 30,000 people lost their jobs. Stores were closed. Jeffrey the Giraffe, the whole deal, right? It was terrible. Before they went under, though, they had been bought out by a couple of private equity firms, KKR and Bain Capital, who stepped in to, in theory, revamp that company, right, in the way that only private capital can. But they couldn't. And what happened was that Toys R Us, under the burden of this private equity ownership, and I use that phrase advisedly, burden, they went under. We reported on it on Marketplace when it happened. And now, ever increasingly since then, similar stories are cropping up. A lot of companies who are supposed to be being rescued by private equity and that kind of capital are not. And that's what we're going to talk about.
And of course, it's much bigger than Toys R Us, and it's much bigger than retail. We are going to focus on that today, because I think you've seen so many big name brands go bankrupt after being bought out by private equity, like Payless, The Limited, Gymboree, Sports Authority. But it really is private equity, I think, the man behind the curtain of a lot of the American economy right now. You may have seen recently that Taylor Swift was in a big, huge fight with
a private
equity company that owned the rights to a lot of her music catalog, and were the American Music Awards even going to happen, and that kind of thing. Apparently, it's quite a scandal, because it's increasingly involved in English Premier League. Like, you're seeing private equity companies take big ownership stakes in Manchester United. And anyway, according to a study published in July, private equity is directly responsible for more than 500,000 jobs lost in the last decade alone, indirectly responsible for up to 1.3 million jobs lost overall. And so, as a result, and I think because of these high-profile bankruptcies, it's starting to get some backlash among progressive politicians, becoming exhibit A for one of the cases that it's time to rein in Wall Street.
Today, it's about Wall Street, in particular, private equity.
Anyone remember Shopko? You know why Shopko's closed? Private equity.
Toys R Us, 30,000 jobs wiped out. Shopko, 14,000 jobs. Brookstone, David's Bridal, Payless. Private equity is behind 597,000 lost jobs.
We are making Wall Street nervous.
So that's good. I identified like five of those voices. I was pretty happy with
myself. Think I did too. The only one I don't know is the first one. I will say we do have a recognizable political class.
Yes. Yep. So, to the aforementioned very special guest, Marketplace reporter Mariel Segarra has been covering retail for us and Toys R Us story specifically for a couple of years, working on a special series about how we shop. And we're going to have a good conversation with her. Mariel, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. So I feel like the Toys R Us, I really do think the Toys R Us thing, I mean, I can just say from personal experience, for me, that was a big wake-up call. Like, I thought, wait a second, Toys R Us hadn't necessarily not been making money. It just had a huge debt burden because of this buyout. Like, how does this all work and leave a company, in some cases, in worse standing than when it started?
Yeah, private equity, it can be a bit confusing for people because it can actually mean a lot of things. In this case, we're talking about something called a leveraged buyout. But private equity firms are just investment firms, right? They bundle together money from different kinds of investors, some wealthy individuals, also pension funds and endowments and foundations. They take that money and they make investments that in many cases yield higher returns than the stock market. And one of those kinds of investments is when they buy a company and try to flip it. And that's called a leveraged buyout. And that's what we're talking about here in all of these cases. You know, all the bankruptcies, Claire's, David's Bridal, Payless, Gymboree, Toys R Us, like all leveraged buyouts. And I can just sort of explain what that is.
Yeah, because the leveraged part that's the key thing, right? Yep. It's the debt that gets piled on that these companies can't pay. And I think we ought to unpack that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when they buy these companies, their plan is to flip them within a few years. They want to buy at a low price and sell at a higher price. They often do that by coming in and cutting costs, laying people off, cutting their benefits, cutting hours. That's something that gets a lot of attention. But also, yeah, the way that they do this, the leverage part of it, I'll use Toys R Us as an example. Mm-hmm. They were bought for, I believe it was $6.6 billion by Bain and KKR. They didn't put that money up in cash. They put up, it was about 20% of it, and then they borrowed the rest. So they borrowed $5 billion, and then immediately after buying Toys R Us, they put that debt on Toys R Us's books. And that's how a leveraged buyout works. You take out money to buy a company, and then once you have the company, you make the company pay that money back. And so these companies are just drowning in debt. And it can actually, these things can be successful. They have been successful and, you know, ended up in very high returns for investors and not ended up in bankruptcy. But if something happens in an industry, if an asteroid hits, in this case, the asteroid was Amazon, it makes it very difficult for the company that has $5 billion of debt on its books and payments to make every month. It makes it very difficult for them to spend any other money to compete or, you know, improve their online operations.
And the same thing happens in media, too, right? You have newspaper companies being bought up by private equity, and then this asteroid called the internet and online advertising comes and kaboom, right?
Right. Yeah, same idea. And private equity can work particularly well in growing industries. It's worked well in healthcare. It's even worked well in with a couple of retailers that were bought around the same time as all these other ones. So like Michaels and Dollar General are two examples of leveraged buyouts that actually went the way they were supposed to. And both of those companies were taken public and the private equity companies, private equity firms cashed out. But for the most part, though, yes, this has failed in retail and it's you see the same things happening in media.
Hmm. Are there any rules? I mean, are there any rules that say, I know, sorry. I feel like I'm always the one asking that. I'm such. Shouldn't there be like a rule that says that maybe that is too much debt or there should be some kind of a calculation that you do that says this company can definitely. I mean, I guess what I wonder is, as an investment class, how risky is private equity? And is it kind of like you get what you...
Well,
is it sort of like it's a risky class and everybody knows that? Or are there any rules in place that say this should work most of the time?
I think both of those things are true. Yeah. So on the rules, there are rules that private equity firms have to follow, but they're not regulated in the same way that banks are or that public companies are. Under Dodd-Frank, they introduced some new regulations for private equity firms. Now, if they're above a certain size, they have to register with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and they have to report certain information about their employees, about conflicts of interest, about the size of their companies. But it's very limited. And a lot of the things that we've been talking about, you know, when a leveraged buyout ends up in a bankruptcy, often it's the workers who lose. They lose out on severance that they were supposed to get. They lose their jobs. Their jobs just disappear. Executives end up still getting paid huge bonuses, even through the bankruptcy process. And so there was a bill introduced this summer by Democrats that would address some of those things, that would attempt to put regulation around that. It does not have a chance in a Republican-controlled Senate. But that shows you how limited the rules are.
Yeah. Let me put on my private equity guy hat here for a second and offer this thought. All we're doing is aiding in the flow of capital through this economy. And if these industries into which we have pumped this money can't keep up, that's on them, man. It's not on us.
Yeah, I think that there's an argument to be made that private equity firms, they target companies that were already struggling in some sense, that they think that they could make more profitable. Companies that they say might have eventually filed for bankruptcy anyway. And so when these things are successful, they say that they saved a company.
Right.
And that they're actually adding value to the economy. They also say that they point out that their returns are often higher than that of the stock market. And so for regular people who have pension plans that want to invest in private equity funds, that can also add value to the economy. So, and yeah, I mean, I don't think that any private equity firms want to see their investments fail.
Right.
They didn't want to see bankruptcy isn't the option that they wanted. But I think it's true that when they do fail, the people who lose out the most are not the private equity firms. Right. They're the workers.
Yep.
Right. Also, though, I mean, I wonder, is this, like so many things, an issue of scale? Is there more private equity money now? You know, is this sort of a spreading? Because it does feel like as you look around and you look at just this list of names that we've talked about just in retail, it seems like private equity's tentacles are everywhere. And I wonder how much that has increased in the last, you know, decade or so, because it just feels like there's a ton of money around.
I know that it has increased. And also, private equity is in a lot of industries and services that you wouldn't even imagine. So one thing private equity firms do, after the financial crisis, they bought up a ton of homes in foreclosure, and now they're renting them out. And so you have a private equity landlord. They also have gotten into municipal services. So cities that are having trouble running their sewer systems or water systems or even emergency services like 911 have gone to private equity and partnered with them, if you want to call it that. And so now what you might get is improved. You might get new pipes, you know, in your water system, and it might be more reliable, but also your rates go up exorbitantly, and maybe you have to move. Or maybe, you know, there was reporting in the New York Times on this about 911 now being run by private equity firms in different towns and the response times not being fast enough, or firefighters being provided by private equity firms.
Right.
Yeah. So just back to Molly's regulatory question here, right? Because obviously, unrestrained capitalism, which this is a pretty good example of, can lead to not great results for a lot of people. Having some passing familiarity with Congress of the United States, what are the odds that any of this gets regulated for reals, you know, like substantively?
Yeah, right now I think the odds are very low with the with the makeup of the House and the Senate that we have right now. When you look at the bill that came out this summer, it was sponsored solely by Democrats in the House and Senate. So there's as on many issues, there's wide disagreement here about whether private equity is a good thing or a bad thing for the economy. I don't think, unless the makeup of the House and the Senate changes, I don't see anything passing on this.
Well, that seems like a sort of typically bummer place to leave it.
I should ask the questions, man.
Sorry.
Mary Elsegarra, thank you so much for coming on Make Me Smart. You can find Mariel's reporting on the Toys R Us story and all things retail at marketplace.org. Because she's great.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
Well, there we go. I did not mean to end it on a downer. I'm just saying.
No, I don't think you did.
All right.
I mean, I think as with so many things, we want to talk about it being good or bad. And the question is, like, can it be good with limits?
Right.
Or bad without them?
Bad without them. And look, just to complete the circle here of where we started up at the top with all that vox from the politicians, if you've got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren advocating for something that value neutral here, that polarizes the discussion. That's just the way it is, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that has to be taken into consideration when you think about regulations, which is exactly what Mariel did. Anyway,
well,
there
I think you,
go.
I mean, I think the reason to have this conversation is because it has been such an invisible force for so long. And we are starting to now see, you know, we talked about that study in July about how many jobs have been lost. that's data that I think people aren't aware of, that publicly, you know, private equity owned companies are twice as likely to go bankrupt as publicly owned companies, that almost 6 million Americans work for companies owned by private equity, even if they don't know it.
Right.
Well, that it's in schools and, yeah, and football clubs. And, you know, so I think the question of the politics becomes ultimately a question of constituents. Like, if people start to become aware and go, oh, yeah, this is not.
Yeah.
I thought I was working for a company that was just trying to sort of like be sustainable as opposed to get kick-ass returns. Oops, sorry.
Well, well, I think you could say that. But also, it's the epitome of the fallacy of shareholder value. Because you're creating value,
it
in this
really
case,
is
for an extremely concentrated set of shareholders at large cost to others in that chain. And that's the way
it goes. The incentives, yeah, as always.
Yep.
Or what do the, yep, thing. All right, 2019 is winding down. That means it is going to be time for our year-end predictions. In the next few weeks, you're going to hear from Kai and me about what we think is going to happen next year. But we also want to hear from you. And of course, we want to hear your thoughts on this episode and all the other ones that came before it. But what do you think is going to happen in 2020? Send your prediction, ideally as a voice memo, please. Make me smart. At marketplace.org, and we have a little guide up on our website, makemesmart.org, on how to do that. Make a voice memo. We'll be right back.
All right, we're back, and once again, one of us is ready for this conversation, and the other one... is not.
Yeah.
I guess you're just going to wing
it. Oh, no.
It,
this time, I'm calling in Skunk.
All right. Well, now we need to tell people what's going on.
I do not have a news fix. Yeah, we do. This is why. No shame in my game. I don't know what's happening in the news, and I don't really care, because two dogs who live in my house got skunked two nights ago at 10:30 at night, and all I have done since then is try to de-stinkify myself and every piece of fabric and animal.
So what?
I mean, I can tell you some things that work and don't work. If that would be helpful,
maybe
news
we could
fix.
Maybe we could put that online, and you know, that'll be the web digital bonus for the episode today.
We
but
should.
What happened?
We
I mean, were you sitting there with a glass of wine and reading a book contentedly, and the dog came in smelling like skunk? Is that what happened?
I mean, basically, no. So it was bedtime, and I let them out into the backyard for their bedtime pee.
Yep.
And they just went shooting out into the yard, and I saw it. I saw that little monster. And I immediately ran out behind them shouting, like, no, no. And then I, like, one of them had gotten skunked and the other one was still chasing the skunk. And so while I went to the one who was chasing the skunk thinking, oh, he's going to get sprayed, the one who had gotten sprayed, unbeknownst to me, ran into the house and rubbed his little spray body all over every couch and bed that he could find.
Oh,
the entire
house. You didn't close the door on
the
way out. Oh, man. Oh, geez.
No, because I was in a panic. I was like,
yeah,
get away from the thing.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, no. I mean, I failed in so many ways. And then...
Well, no,
look, the whole house smells like gasoline and onions. So maybe things are happening. Yeah, thank you. Well played.
Oh, my goodness.
Well played, producers. So
oh,
it's possible that things are happening in the world, but I don't really know what they are. And I can tell you
nothing.
That's kind of peaceful.
Nothing's happening.
But as an update, I have now watched 3 episodes of The Mandalorian.
Oh.
I'm back.
Right.
I'm back.
All right.
Thought I was out, but I was encouraged to continue.
I think we should just leave it there.
And that is my antidote to these troubled times.
I don't think we need any more on a news fix segment than just that. So let's move right along, shall we?
Okay.
Seriously, let's.
I think that sounds great.
Yeah.
It's nice not to know.
Yeah.
It's nice. You should
there
try
we go.
It.
Let's all live in
ignorance. Not the way I tried it.
No. Skunkless.
All right. We're going to hear from you guys in a minute. But before we do, today is Giving Tuesday. I'm taking the ASPCA off of my list just for today. No critters. Anyway, after all the shopping and the sales, Giving Tuesday is a day to think about the causes and the organizations that matter most to you, to do those end of year donations, make sure you're maximizing your tax deductions. And we hope that that list includes news you trust.
Like us?
Yes.
Look, so here's the deal. And all y'all know this, but we kind of have to say it anyway. Nonprofit public service journalism is what we do. You need it. We need it. The country needs it. But we have to have support from all y'all to keep it going. So we beseech you to include us in your year-end giving plans, if you would. Marketplace.org/donate is where you can do that.
Yep. And since it is the donation time of the year, we have a deal.
Of course.
We got a deal going. This week only, just like, you know, all the cybers. For this week only, our friends at the Candida Fund, who, near as I can tell, literally just exist to match donations, which is kind of awesome. They are matching the donations, though, for this week only, 2 for 1. I've actually never heard of this. This is very exciting. Yeah. I'm somewhat new still to public media, and this is a big deal. I'm like staring at the rundown in delight right now. You'll see it on the video. Your donation has 3 times the impact. This is the first time that we have ever done this, and it's only happening for a few more days. So give now. Marketplace.org/donate.
Please.
I'm really
keep Molly
I'm like
happy.
Really
keep
pretty
Molly
excited
entertaining. Keep us all employed. How about that? How about that's a better one, right? Keep Molly happy and keep the rest of us employed. How about that? 2-1
true.
Matching from the Candida
It turns
fund.
Out Market. I need a large white vinegar budget that I
yes,
didn't expect.
That's right. Marketplace.org/donate. Please, we need your help. Thanks.
All right. And now it is your turn.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
God, GDPR seems like so very long ago.
It really does. We may have to update our state.
I know, right? Speaking of what I love, can we keep that last guy?
Yeah, I mean, okay, that guy, right, he's, okay. He's never going.
Speaking of long ago, we did our Explain-a-thon last week. One of the questions we took was about whether rural America might get left behind as electric vehicle infrastructure, which is to say charging stations and stuff like that, expands on the coasts, but maybe not so much in the middle of the country. Got a couple of comments on that. Here's one from Fez Imam, who says maybe we're looking at it the wrong way.
I think the fallacy we're making is we're thinking of EVs like gas-powered cars when we should be thinking of EVs like cell phones. We can charge our cell phones very quickly if we want, but there's nothing stopping us from charging them slowly anywhere, anytime. Similarly, I've seen a number of EV enthusiasts who live in rural areas and are able to charge their EVs in the middle of nowhere, perhaps more slowly than with dedicated infrastructure, but very capably. And this has allowed them to, in fact, be more self-sufficient because they're totally disconnected from the oil and gas infrastructure. And so I think if we flip the way we think about charging from a centralized location we have to go to something that's available to us in a 110 to 240 volt socket everywhere, it can change the way we use vehicles. Thanks. Love the show.
So I think that's totally right. I do think that mm-hmm. the caveat there is time, right? I mean, if I need to go pick up the kids up from school and they're 30 miles away, I'm making these numbers up, and I've got 22 miles left on the range of my EV and school gets out at 3:10, you know, what speed is the train moving in the opposite direction at, right? You know what I mean? And having yep. to do that math is a little hard. But look, he's totally right. Provided we have the time to charge slowly, I think that probably works.
I think there's never been a better kibosh on electric car purchasing, though, than the idea that you're going to have to do like a complicated verbal equation to figure out how you're... Yeah. No, I mean, I can tell you that I'm fascinated with this idea of decentralization as an antidote and an adaptation technique. But I do think, you know, you still do fundamentally have this question of like, how far can you go?
Right.
And can you charge at that place to get back home?
Yep.
And that's the big, I mean, you know, I grew up in a state where we considered a 5.5 hour road trip to be not very far, like practically a day trip.
Exactly.
But you need charging all along.
For sure. Speaking of which, by the way, needing charging, we occasionally need charging on the explain-a-thons because we don't know everything, although, well, I certainly think I do, but I won't
Smooth.
Speak for this one. One of the questions we took a pass on, in fact, only one of the questions because we only passed on one, was how should our economic indicators change to reflect a service-based economy rather than a manufacturing one? Tony Wagner, to whom we passed, did not let us down. He got Marketplace reporter Mitchell Hartman to answer that one for us in a blog post, and you can find it at makemesmart.org. Click on the episode page for the explain-a-thon.
And that's what I like to call the double delegation.
I know, right?
Yep.
That's exactly
we
right.
We delegate to Tony, like, yeah, Tony delegates to Mitchell. That is an efficient process right there. The week before the explain-a-thon, we talked with economist Esther Duflo about her Nobel Award-winning work, Alleviating Poverty Using Randomized Controlled Trials. Here is a comment from a listener named Mayu about RCTs in social science.
Hey, Kai and Molly. This is Mayu in Pennsylvania. I listened to your interview with Esther Duflo, and I want to suggest another possible reason why randomized controlled trials aren't used more often in economic research. So one of the frustrating things about social science research in general is that a lot of the questions really don't lend themselves to randomized controlled trials because they would be impossible or unethical or impractical to perform. Like, if I want to study the effect of childhood trauma on addiction later in life, I can't just randomly choose 100 children and traumatize them and then see what happens. And I think this is a particularly common problem in economics, and I wonder if maybe as a result, a lot of economists don't even think about randomized controlled trials when they think about the techniques they have at their disposal. So kudos to Dr. Duflo and her colleagues for taking a broad view and recognizing the usefulness of these methods in their work. Love the show. Thanks for doing what you do.
That's a good point.
It is a good point, but aren't the kids already traumatized by the poverty, right? We're not taking them from comfortable living and saying, all right, $2 a day, go. And you're six years old.
Oh, no, yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. Okay. I think he's just saying that's because I was like, isn't this how science is supposed to work?
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
She was saying not in the social sciences. And he right. makes a good point right. about why yep. it hasn't necessarily been.
Yeah.
Why you can't always create a problem just to test.
Right.
If it already exists, then absolutely.
Yes. Yes. All right. So also in that interview, we talked about classroom size. And I said that class size does not always make as big of an impact as people think it does. Also, one of the findings that Duflo came across in her studies in India. And here is Dee Burley chiming in on that point.
Hi, Kai and Molly. I enjoy listening to your podcast, but I was a little concerned the other week when I heard from you that class sizes do not improve educational outcomes. My understanding was, first, that the research that was being done was in developing countries, where there may be a lot of other more important factors. But second, the research that I've done as a teacher and as a person with an education master's indicated that while class sizes are not the only thing, having a class size that's huge certainly doesn't help. I would love to see some clarification on this issue, especially as everyone already seems to know what they think needs to happen in America's classrooms.
So, I have a very good friend who is deeply experienced in education policy and has occupied senior government positions and also in the private sector at a very senior level, who shared that mm-hmm. with me over a number of beers one night a number of years ago. So I will double check and I will get some sourcing from him and we will figure that out. I would say
share
though
that about class size working. You mean?
Yeah, because mm-hmm. we have thrilling discussions at my house. But I think we're saying the same thing, right? That
yeah.
My point was class size is not dispositive. Her point is that huge classes don't necessarily help. And I think that's sure. sort of similar things anyway.
Definitely. And all then right. yes, when it comes to Esther Duflo's research, yeah. it was done yeah. in developing countries where yeah. there may be significant differences. But yeah, believe me. For if only to avoid further voicemails, I in no way intend to prescribe what I think should happen in America's
yeah, oh yeah,
classrooms.
For sure. Yeah. yeah.
I'm just going to suffer
yep.
through
yep.
America's classrooms for a few more years.
Just
last but
more.
Not least, here is our Make Me Smart question, an answer to the question, in fact, which is, of course, what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about? This answer comes from listener Linda Lynch.
Hi, Molly and Kai. This is Linda from El Segundo, California. The Make Me Smart question, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? My husband and I have always prided ourselves on being as efficient as possible in our work and personal lives. You could say we are a bit obsessed with efficiency. I thought that striving for efficiency made us better. However, as I've gotten older and wiser, I've learned that we have been wrong. In so many parts of life, efficiency isn't the best option. Children don't learn best by learning efficiently. They learn by circuitous exploration and wasted time. Most important relationships don't develop efficiently. They unfold in myriad ways. The economy is not based on efficiency. In fact, I would argue that our economy is based on lots of wasted time. Think countless hours paid to employees on unused projects. Think coffee breaks at Starbucks. And look at tech. While Google has certainly made our search for information much more efficient, Facebook and Instagram rely on lots of wasted time, the black hole of social media. So while my husband and I will continue to strive for efficiency, we've learned to scale back our obsession a notch. What we have thought of as wasted time may just be the good stuff that propels our economy, inspires new innovations, and makes our lives fuller. And thanks, Molly and Kai. Make Me Smart certainly makes efficient use of my travel time.
I'm not going to argue Aww. With anything right there. That's
I know. Good. I love that. That's funny, actually, because while I was in the midst of the skunk disaster, a friend called and basically was like, hey, I'm gonna pass on a saying that I have heard many times that I think applies in this moment, which is don't just do something. Sit there.
Sit there. Right. Yep.
It was like, just yep. sit down, breathe.
Yeah.
Like, it's going to be fine. Don't feel like you have to, you know, solve this whole problem. Which, of course, caused me to be like, if I don't do it, it'll last for months.
Yeah.
Anyway, eventually I did sit down and it was really good advice. Yeah.
But I understand also being slightly panicked at that smell in your house and having to do something. So, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But what a good saying.
Yes.
Don't just do something. Sit there. Love it. You guys are always so smart. All right. That is it for the podcast. But you can always find more of us, more of Kai and me. We are everywhere. In the form of your smart listening device. Every day, actually, we bring you a one-minute explainer on your Amazon Echo device. Just tell the Amazon lady, you know, to make me smart.
There we go. The music's saving us from ourselves.
Just vamping. Once again. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, and our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thanks to our video producers, Ben Hethcote and Cynthia Betubiza in New York. God, that's also fun to say. And, of course, to Erica Phillips, who writes our newsletter, and Alexa Skill.
And tweets random stuff. This week's program was engineered by Ben Tolliday. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez, the executive director of On Demand. Although I haven't seen her in the office lately, so I don't even know if she still works here. It's Sitar Nieves, the senior vice president and general manager. I think it's still Deborah Clark. I don't know. This will be a little test.
I don't know.
Do they listen to the end?
I guess they'll email us.
Do they listen to the end? I know.
And or they still
work
here.
So silence will be dispositive.
I feel like I would have gotten an email, but I
well,
maybe not.
You will now, sister. All right. I said dispositive twice in that podcast. So let's talk, Stinky. How you doing?
Not good. Not good.
Sorry.
Uh-uh. Yeah. Marielle?
Yes?
Here's what happened. I tried to do a good deed in the world and foster a dog.
Okay.
That has turned my fucking life upside down. He proceeded to have, like, a totally botched neuter surgery, and he's been in a cone for 2 weeks with this, like, massive wound, which reopened on Thanksgiving. And then we were like, almost out of the woods.
Better.
Like, he's getting his stitches out today. It was going to be great. And then both dogs ran into the backyard and got skunked two nights ago at 10:30.
Oh, God.
And I was trying to get one dog away from the skunk, then the second dog, you just cry. You basically just cry for like 24 hours.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.